Our text this evening from Judges is the third chapter, beginning at the 12th verse, and reading to verse 31, the end of chapter 3. Judges 3, 12 to 31. We have begun our consideration of the narrative of the individual judges themselves. Last time we considered Othniel, whose deliverance of Israel from an oppressor was described in sketch only, a skeletal narrative lacking detail. This is not a case with our next judge, Ehud. So we begin to read at verse 12. Once again the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and because they did this evil, the Lord gave Eglon, king of Moab, power over Israel. Remember, the account of each judge and his career is presented in a formulaic way, with the formula harking back to the general introduction and explanation of this history that we were given in the prologue. So verse 12 of chapter 3 reads like verse 7 of chapter 3, which reads like verse 11 of chapter 2. So we'll find here the same basic sequence as we had in the prologue and as we had again in the previous paragraph: Israel's apostasy, her subjugation to an oppressor, her appeal to the Lord raising up for her a deliverer, and peace, then for a period of time. Now, while we were uncertain of the identity of Israel's oppressor in the previous paragraph, there's no question about Eglon, king of Moab. We know where Moab was and can imagine who Eglon was. Nor is the nature of the oppression itself unstated, as it was before. Jericho was taken and kept, as we will learn, and tribute was exacted from Israel, as we will read in verse 15. Getting the Ammonites and the Amalekites to join him, Eglon came and attacked Israel, and they took possession of the city of palms, that's Jericho. The Israelites were subject to Eglon, king of Moab, for 18 years. Now, as will be typical of many episodes in Israel's history, not just in the book of Judges, God's providence is unrecognized by the pagan nations that the Lord employs to punish or to discipline his own people. Eglon did not see himself as the Lord's agent. He saw an opportunity and he took it. There was nothing righteous in what he did, so far as he was concerned. And so it will come as no surprise that he can be punished for doing what God used him to do in the history of his people. The same will be true later on a much larger scale with empires such as Assyria and Babylon. This is an instance of which there are many in the Bible, and a great many more in human life of our own observation, of God using sin sinlessly, as an old pastor of mine used to put it. Again, the Israelites cried out to the Lord, and he gave them a deliverer, Ehud, a left-handed man, the son of Gera, the Benjamite. The Israelites sent him with tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now, several details here are of importance to the unfolding story. The Benjaminites were noted for their prowess as fighters, and Ehud being left-handed meant that it was easier for him to surprise the king with a fatal stroke. Almost all swordsmen were right-handed. Even generally speaking, left-handed men wielded their sword with their right hand and carried their spear with their left. That meant that the king would not be inclined to worry about a movement of the left hand. As we will learn later in chapter 20, verse 16, which you can put in the margin there against verse 15, the Benjaminites were famous for left-handed warriors of uncommon military prowess. Now, to be accurate, the translation left-handed is something of a guess. It's a good guess, but it nevertheless is something of a guess. If it doesn't mean left-handed, it probably means ambidextrous. The practical point in either case would be the same. He could wield the dagger with his left hand, the unexpected hand. No matter the translation, there is no doubt that he was a capable warrior with his left hand, an unusual trait then as now. Now Ehud had made a double-edged sword, about a foot and a half long, which he strapped to his right thigh under his clothing. The Israelites sent tribute, but Ehud made a sword. The Israelites sent tribute, but Ehud made a sword. The implication is that Israel knew nothing about Ehud's plans until after the assassination. The narrator doesn't tell us how Ehud knew to do this or what prompted him to do this. He's more interested in telling us that it was the Lord who gave this man to be Israel's deliverer. Also, what follows clearly is no spur-of-the-moment decision on Ehud's part. He plans meticulously. He even makes a special dagger for use in the assassination. And that dagger was double-edged, made for a single stroke forward, not a hacking stroke from above or behind. It also seems to have been made without a hilt, as we will read in verse 22, as the handle sunk in as well as the blade when Ehud stabbed Eglon. Because he strapped it to his right thigh, no one would be inclined to look for it there. Swordsman being right-handed, the sword was carried on the left hip. He presented the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab, who was a very fat man. After Ehud had presented the tribute, he sent on their way the men who had carried it. At the idols near Gilgal, he himself turned back and said, "I have a secret message for you, O king." Israel had no answer for Eglon's military might and prowess. But the narrator is going to leave us in no doubt that, in fact, Eglon is a man to be made fun of. He is obese, as everyone knows, and he's a fool, as soon we will learn. He has become, as one commentator puts it, a large, slow-moving target. His unwarrior girth and his gullibility render him Ehud's patsy. Now, the reference to the idols may indicate that they were part of Ehud's deception. Stopping there may have been with the intention of making it appear that he had received from the gods an oracle, a divine communication for Eglon. Make it more likely that Eglon would take seriously what was being said to him. Or they may have represented some kind of boundary between Israelite territory and that controlled by Moab, as verse 26 later in the narrative may suggest. In any case, they are understated evidence that idol worship was a regular feature of life in the Promised Land even after Israel occupied it. They also raise some question in the reader's mind, a question that the narrator does not necessarily dispel as to Ehud's total loyalty to the Lord. After all, in what follows in the book as a whole, it becomes clear that the Lord uses what material he finds. The judges are themselves hardly a group of men who we will find to be noted for their sterling godliness. Is there something here that suggests that Ehud himself was in some way taken up with the worship of idols? Eglon is so gullible, so hungry for Ehud's secret communication, that he dismisses his bodyguard and thereby makes it easy for Ehud to escape after assassinating the king. Eglon presumably supposed that Ehud had some intelligence for him, the kind of information that an Israelite collaborator may have for the man who wields the real power in his country. The king said, "Quiet," and all his attendants left him. Ehud then approached him while he was sitting alone in the upper room of his summer palace and said, "I have a message from God for you." As the king rose from his seat, perhaps to receive an oracle, a divine oracle, Ehud reached with his left hand, drew the sword from his right thigh, and plunged it into the king's belly. It is, by the way, quite unusual for a biblical narrator to pay such careful attention to the details of the killing. We might very well expect to find this in the Iliad, for example, but not so much in the Bible. And that leads us to believe that the narrator has something to say to us with all of these details. Even the handle sunk in after the blade which came out his back. Ehud did not pull the sword out, and the fat closed in over it. Then Ehud went out to the porch. He shut the doors of the upper room behind him and locked them. After he had gone, the servants came and found the doors of the upper room locked. They said, he must be relieving himself in the inner room of the house. They waited to the point of embarrassment, but when he did not open the doors of the room, they took a key and unlocked them. There they saw their lord fallen to the floor, dead. The comic stupidity of Eglon is matched by that of his servants. Their blundering obtuseness makes it an easy thing for the Lord's man not only to commit his crime, but to get away with it, to make good his escape. And now we're going to find out that what was true of the king and his court in Moab is also to be proved true of the entire Moabite army. But what is clear, though it is assumed and not spelled out, is that the Lord saw to making every one of Ehud's deceptions effective. At no point is his plan discovered. At no point did any of his subterfuges fail to work. One commentator describes it this way: even in stories where divine activity is not highlighted, the author surely sees the hand of God at work and expects his readers to recognize it as well. The account of Ehud's successful assassination of Eglon is not simply humorous, but it is also characterized by his amazing good luck in being able to smuggle in a sword, obtain a personal audience with Eglon, and escape without the palace guards realizing that anything was amiss. But Judges sees Ehud as a deliverer sent by God in answer to Israel's prayer. So his success should not be ascribed to luck, but to providence. While they waited, Ehud got away. He passed by the idols and escaped to Syra. When he arrived there, he blew a trumpet in the hill country of Ephraim, and the Israelites went down with him from the hills, with him leading them, probably primarily just Ephraimites from that tribe. Now, you cannot tell this in English, but the verb translated blew the trumpet, is the same one translated plunged in verse 21 to describe the dagger stroke. This kind of repetition of a key word is a way the author links Eglon's assassination by Ehud to the successful war of liberation that follows. The first not only leads to the second, but it's a kind of anticipation or prefigurement of it. Now Ehud is no longer the lone avenger. He functions as a military commander. Follow me, he ordered, for the Lord has given Moab, your enemy, into his hands, or into your hands. So they followed him down, and taking possession of the fords of the Jordan that led to Moab, they allowed no one to cross over. In another such connection between the first half of the story and the second, the assassination and the brief war or battle, you have in verse 15, the Lord gave Israel a deliverer, and in verse 28, the Lord has given Moab into your hands. Obviously, there's a point here the narrator is attempting to make. There's a connection between the first part and the second. The individual deliverer not only rids Israel of the king, but he shows himself the Lord's man and Israel's leader and makes it clear to Israel that she should follow him. At that time, they struck down about 10,000 Moabites, all vigorous and strong. Not a man escaped. Now, what appears to have happened is that Israel assumed the position of military advantage and then cut up the Moabite army that foolishly attacked a strongly situated enemy. She had taken control of the fords of the Jordan. The Moabite army is now like her dead leader, not exactly the sharpest knife in the drawer. That's the idea. Interestingly, the adjective the NIV renders vigorous is the word that also means fat, almost certainly a play on Eglon's obesity. It's like the English word, very like the English word stout, that can refer either to body shape or to firmness of resolution. The Moabite army was as lumbering as their portly king. And not one man escaped. When the Lord delivers his people, he delivers his people. Eglon, who had proved too much for faithless Israel, is then easily dispatched by a single man, the Lord's deliverer. And now, Eglon's army that had been too much for faithless Israel is as easily dispatched by the army of one Israelite tribe. That day, Moab was made subject to Israel, and the land had peace for 80 years. After Ehud came Shamgar, son of Anat, who struck down 600 Philistines with an ox goad. He too saved Israel. Now, the brief reference to Shamgar reinforces and seems to be designed to reinforce the impression of the previous narrative. The connection between the two accounts, one much longer and one very short, is indicated not only by the after Ehud with which it begins, but by the he too in the last phrase. Here the weapon is still more makeshift. The enemies of Israel are made to look still more ridiculous. One man killing 600 soldiers with an ox goad. And the point is clear as the account ends. It's a small thing for the Lord to deliver his people from their enemies. He can use anyone to do it, and with the Lord's strength and wisdom, anyone can do it. In fact, though it is a story too long to tell, there is some linguistic and inscriptional evidence that may suggest that Shamgar was not an Israelite at all, but a warrior in the employ of the Egyptian pharaoh. In such a case, Shamgar would have been dealing with the Philistines on behalf of Egyptian interests and would have had no intention whatsoever of delivering the Israelites from the Philistines. But God used his prowess to relieve his people. That might further explain why so little is said about him. He wasn't an Israelite, really. He wasn't a judge in the same way that Othniel was or Ehud was, one of God's people, acting on God's behalf to deliver God's people. Now, what we have said, or what we have in these accounts, most notably in the longer and more detailed account of Ehud, and what we will have in all the accounts of the judges, is what theologians call concursus. So we introduce this subject here at the headwaters of the narrative of the judges. Concursus is a division or a subtopic of the doctrine of divine providence. The doctrine of providence, as you know, founded on 1,000 explicit and unmistakable texts in Holy Scripture, is the teaching that everything that happens in the world and everything that happens in every individual human life is ultimately the will and the purpose of God. He has a plan, and he works out everything according to the purpose of his will, as Paul says summarily in Ephesians chapter 1, verse 11. That plan embraces everything, down to the very number of hairs on your head at any single moment of your life. The doctrine of concursus, again founded on many statements in the Bible, is the teaching that God uses many means to accomplish this plan that he has for every life and for the entire world. And that as a result, the same event may be said to be caused by God or by man. The same event may be said to be the result of the will of God or natural forces. That is, you have different causes on different levels concurring in the same event or the same result. The same hurricane may be said to be sent by God or caused by climatic factors. The same death may be both the will of God who numbers our days and the result of a man who fails to buckle his seatbelt or who drinks before he drives. We are taught, that is, in the Bible, to take with absolute seriousness the reality of what philosophers call second causes, that is, to consider these second causes as real causes, to study the climate, to buckle our seatbelts or else, to acquire medical knowledge and avail ourselves of it when we are sick and so on, and at the same time to believe that nothing in this world, nothing that happens to us or to anyone else, occurs by accident. That there is an ultimate cause, the will of God, does not mean that second causes are not real causes. And that second causes are real causes does not mean that God's will is not the final reason for everything that happens. Basil of Caesarea, the church father, famously put it that chance is a pagan term. And we would say yes, but yes and no. Spin the cylinder with six chambers, but only one loaded, and pull the trigger, and sooner or later the gun will fire. Throw the die, and over time the numbers will turn up as the laws of probability predict. But it is also true, and more ultimately true, as we read in Proverbs chapter 16, the lot is thrown into the lap, but every decision is from the Lord. He made the second causes and made them to be real causes. He wants our life to be lived in this responsible and understanding way. But he also determines what comes to pass in this world. He did not make the world and set it loose as a venture. He knows what he wants to happen in it, with it, and through it. And he sees that it does. But he uses real means. This point is simply but powerfully made in the Ehud account and will be made in the accounts that follow. The Lord raised this man up and gave him to Israel as a deliverer. The Lord gave Israel victory over Moab. That much is explicitly stated. But the means of that deliverance are deception and sleight of hand first, and then sound tactics leading to victory in battle second. Not the one or the other, God's will or Ehud's trickery, but both, one the means of the other. It's interesting how in Judges the emphasis falls on both and powerfully at the same time. The statement in verse 15 that the Lord gave Israel a deliverer in Ehud opens the narrative of deliverance, and the statement in verse 28 that the Lord gave Moab into Israel's hands closes that narrative. The Lord gave is a kind of inclusio, framing the narrative and reminding us what's happening here. The Lord gave deliverance to his people. But in between those affirmations of divine sovereignty and God's provision, all the emphasis falls on the clever machinations of Ehud, his daring one-man attack on the Moabite court. We're told something of Ehud's prowess as a warrior. We're given a glimpse of Ehud planning his strike. We're shown the steps by which he carried it out. And in the juxtaposition of these two emphases in the narrative, the Lord's giving Israel victory and Ehud's clever and daring exploit and the army's victory in the field, we have an almost perfect picture of concursus, as it is taught everywhere in the Bible. It's very like the account we're given in 2 Samuel chapter 23, verses 9 and 10, of Eleazar, one of David's captains. He was with David when they taunted the Philistines gathered at Pas Damim for battle. Then the men of Israel retreated, but he stood his ground and struck down the Philistines till his hand grew tired and froze to the sword. There's the exploit of a great warrior. But what does the narrator say next? The Lord brought about a great victory that day. Troops returned to Eleazar, but only to strip the dead. So we hear about the exploit of this great warrior. And then we hear the Lord brought about a great victory for Israel that day. Now we see this all the time, in lesser and in greater ways. The Lord using means, and in particular, the Lord using men to accomplish his will, to deliver, to save, to bless his people in the world, to deliver, save, or bless his gospel in the world. We've had some wonderful examples of this phenomenon in recent church history in the English-speaking evangelical world. Think, for example, of Francis Schaeffer. As a younger man and well into his adulthood and his life's work, he was not what anyone would have thought or predicted to be a major influence for the kingdom of God in the Western world. Not only in the Western world, but in the rest of the world. One of the most effective apologists to come out of India in recent years is a man who was greatly influenced by Francis Schaeffer, became in fact a Christian reading Francis Schaeffer. But in the 1940s and the early 1950s, he was the pastor of a small to mid-size Bible Presbyterian church in St. Louis, Missouri. He was a minister in a small, marginalized fundamentalist denomination, in other words. When he decided to go to Europe as a missionary, it was with the intention, if you can believe it, of doing children's evangelism. In many ways, humanly speaking, the ministry that became Labrie was an accident, an utterly unintended and unforeseen development that resulted from a combination of Dr. Schaefer's private spiritual struggles and a series of opportunities that God sent his way. It is a giant step from children's evangelism in Europe to articles about one in Time magazine and the major American newspapers. He was taken by many to be a philosopher, though he had no professional training in that discipline and no advanced degree. He was largely self-taught. His books were manifestos, much more than careful examinations of philosophical arguments, and he was often criticized by evangelical academic types who make their lives criticizing other people for his failings as a professional philosopher. But as one perceptive professional philosopher, a professional philosopher put it, his style is swashbuckling. The whole thing is like a speeded up lantern lecture in which pictures, names, and ideas follow each other in breathtaking succession. Points are often suggested rather than proved. But then many seminal works in the history of thought have done the same. What we ought to be concerned with is not the details of the argument, but the main thesis. The fact is, in the 1960s and 70s, Francis Schaefer exercised an immense influence on the thinking not only of the evangelical church, but through it on the Western world. During those years, he was one of the best-selling authors in the United States of America, though many people did not know that because his books were not sold primarily in the stores whose sales the New York Times surveyed to create its list of bestsellers. He spoke at many major universities, dined at the White House, debated major representatives of American religious and intellectual life of the period, such as the Episcopalian Bishop James Pike and the behaviorist philosopher B.F. Skinner. But what is more, he influenced an entire generation of young American Christians and young American scholars. In many ways, he reversed an ebb tide of evangelical thinking and turned it into a flood. Nothing could be more obvious, however, looking back on that history, than that it was the Lord who did this. It makes, however, a remarkable human story to tell. And without a doubt, as this narrator with Ehud, we have to give credit to Francis Schaefer's opportunism, his hard work, his devotion to the cause, his good sense as to how to make the case for Christian truth in the times in which he lived. He was an Ehud facing an Eglon, and his confident attack on the public mind of his day taught a generation of young people that, however outwardly impressive, the public philosophy of the modern Western world was in fact a house of cards. Now we're being treated to another such story, even as we speak. You've heard, of course, of Philip Johnson, the retired, or now retired, law professor from the University of California at Berkeley, a place where one does not expect to find a robust defense of a Christian worldview. Near the end of his career as an honored professor of law in the American Academy, specializing in evidence, Johnson, who had become a Christian in the middle of his life, found almost, it seems by accident, a new passion, a new calling. On sabbatical in England, he read Richard Dawkins' Case for Evolution, The Blind Watchmaker, and at the same time, Michael Denton's, the Australian biochemist's, attack on evolution, Evolution, a Theory in Crisis. Intrigued by what he saw were Dawkins' sleights of hand by which he disguised a lack of evidence for evolution and used a patina of science to mask what was really just naturalistic philosophy and presupposition, he saw a work to be done. He saw an opportunity to strike. Evidence was his specialty. He could smell a trumped-up case. If you've ever seen Philip Johnson, you know how disarming his appearance is. He's a frumpy man in his 60s, quite harmless looking, but he has a powerful intellect. And he began to put it to use, mastering the scientific literature. Really, as a man at the end of one academic career, grasping an entirely new and different discipline, and a very complex and technical one at that, and then he set the scientific world on its ear with the publication of Darwin on Trial in 1991. It's interesting, by the way, to note the connection between Schaefer and Philip Johnson. Charles Thaxton was a young PhD in chemistry who went to study at La Brie with Francis Schaefer. He published in 1984 a very influential book together with two other men, The Mystery of Life's Origin, a book that laid out all the origin of life theories that anybody had devised, together with their shortcomings and their improbabilities. Early on in his new interest in the evolution question, Johnson read and was influenced by Thaxton's book. Anyway, it's Philip Johnson who is behind this small-scale Manhattan project to unseat evolution as the ruling paradigm of thinking about the origin and the meaning of human life. He's brought together a group of young scientists, given them intellectual cover, and created what is now known as the intelligent design movement, not only in the scientific community of the American Academy, but in the socio-political community of American intellectual life and government. And when you see on PBS, most now PBS stations actually showing programs that tout intelligent design and enumerating the problems with typical evolutionary scenarios of the origin of life and the development of life and all of its wonderful complexity and astonishing perfection, when state educational boards are now changing the rules by which evolution is taught in the American public school system, when the textbook companies are now removing discredited arguments from their biology textbooks, and some are actually presenting the case against evolution in these same textbooks, when the movement's books are now being seriously and often favorably reviewed in the American press, when more and more practicing scientists are coming out of the closet and joining the movement publicly, when the United States Senate recently passed a law requiring that evolution be taught as a theory and that negative evidence be included in the presentation, and when the scientific establishment is now running scared, as the level of bitterness and wounded pride in its speech and writing now indicates, it's not hard to see that a great change is underway. A revolution is already in the middle of its course. And that change, humanly speaking, is the work of one man, Philip Johnson, the frumpy law professor who hadn't much thought about evolution until the mid-1980s. Many others have contributed to this effort, many more will, but Johnson is the Ehud to the evolutionary establishment's Eglon. We are now past the assassination, and we are massing at the fords of the Jordan. Now we have scholars in the field confidently pronouncing that in the next 5 years, molecular Darwinism will be dead. That sentiment, still less that confidence, was unheard of just 7 or 8 years ago. But that's how times have changed and how a little man with a big brain has changed them. But it was a Christian man, a man of faith. It might not have been. There was no particular reason why it needed to have been. The fact of the matter is, what's going to bring the evolutionary establishment down is the need for young men to earn PhDs in biology and biochemistry, and still more, for young scholars to earn a reputation in those fields. And there's no better way, when the house of cards is beginning to totter, no better way to make a reputation for yourself than to be the person who causes it to crash. It may not be a Christian motive, as it may not have been a divine or a devout motive in Shamgar's case. It might have been a Shamgar who brought us this far, assuming Shamgar was not an Israelite and wasn't intending to help Israel at all when he took on the Philistines. But in this case, it was. And so the story is worth telling to a Christian audience, as was Ehud's. But let there be no doubt about this. If evolution falls, as it must and will be God who brought it down. And whatever were the means he chose to accomplish his will, it will be his will that was done, both to judge the wicked and deliver his people and his gospel. We learn, we work, we plan, we strike. But we look to God all the while, for without him we can do nothing. Concursus is a view of life that energizes believers while keeping them actively dependent upon the Lord, makes them determined to accomplish things on God's behalf, all the while sure that God alone can make such things come to pass. The lesson of Ehud and the Lord's giving victory to Israel is the lesson that Oliver Cromwell famously taught his Puritan troops, the Roundheads, in the middle of the 17th century, that army that never once lost a battle. He told them, "Trust in God and keep your powder dry." Amen.